As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll be dissecting a humdinger of an FA Cup quarter-final as Erik ten Hag throws off the shackles and stuns Liverpool with a brilliant Manchester United comeback. We'll also discuss Chelsea and own goals and Coventry's thrilling win against Wolverhampton Wanderers. Burnley winning a game will also get a mention, and we'll be hearing about how Gerard Piqué plans to revolutionise football. And joining me for all that, we have two revolutionaries of our own. Times football writers Alison Rudd and Tom Allnutt are here, and a former footballer who claims to have never ever scored an own goal in his professional career, but he did nod one into his own net in the under-16s Edinburgh Schools Cup final as his team lost 2-1. Gregor Robertson, no own goals today,
we
please.
We wouldn't use that one.
Yeah, you asked me not to use that. Okay. It doesn't mean I won't. No, come on.
Thanks.
You know, if you tell me anything, I'm basically going to use it. We're in mid-March now. We're nearly
Julie
there.
Noted.
We're nearly there. I need all the help I can get with facts about your career. Right, let's get to it. The thriller at Old Trafford. Alison, how are you feeling? You all right? Good day? Happy Monday? Yeah.
Not really, no.
Okay. Well, anyway, I was editing yesterday, and it was a remarkable game to follow in respect to the discussion that we had on Thursday's show about deciding topics, working out the flow of the game, what are we going to write about. Paul Joyce and Paul Hurst were messaging me going, what are we going to talk about? So, I mean, in drama terms, match of the season so far, Gregor?
Yeah, I think so.
It was, wasn't it?
I think so.
It was crazy.
Yeah,
all
chaos.
All the storylines, all the chaos, and a victory for kind of bold and brave decision making as well.
Yeah, although you could almost say kind of crazy decision making.
Crazy,
the
absolutely.
The lineup Manchester United had by the end. But yeah, the kind of seesaw and end to end. Also, the number of chances Liverpool had to kind of kill the game off, really, as well. It was just wild. But a huge moment for Manchester United and for Erik ten Hag, and the kind of the image of him strolling on the pitch afterwards with the sort of limbs and just wildness in the stands around him, and sort of he was almost kind of like a little schoolboy looking. I think Paul Hirsch wrote that in his piece today, just kind of looking around him as if like, oh, we've woken up here. This is what Manchester United could be. So I think it could possibly be a turning point for them.
Alison, I wanted to ask you, and I'm not trying to rile you or wind you up, I promise I would never do that to you, but Erik ten Hag and his demeanour on the touchline is something, as a subject that you've talked about on this podcast before. I did find it interesting, and I genuinely was thinking of you in those comments, with some of his reactions both to the goals and how he was driving his team forward. I even like that he had the kind of official club suit on, which I checked with Paul Hurst, and he's like, yeah, he does wear it sometimes, but it all felt like he'd stepped up, he'd thought, right, I'm going to show Alison Rudd here that I really do care.
Well, I had similar, not exactly the same. I had a similar reaction. I did have the overwhelming sense that a below par Man United team who ought to be doing better found something in their hatred of Liverpool that galvanised them. It's slightly odd. Verging on embarrassing that you need to hate a team so much.
Now, come on,
and
you can
to
just,
spoil,
you could just
and
be
to
nice.
spoil the narrative of Klopp ending his career, holding the trophy at Wembley. That spurred on the crowd. They wanted it like they've not wanted a victory for quite a long time. It meant more than the league games. It meant more than the Manchester Derby. They did not like the idea that they would be part of this journey of Klopp. And I suspect that if Ten Hag has any emotional intelligence, and he probably has some, he would have used that in his team talks at the various intervals in this very long game and said, you know, this is the moment we can turn everything on its head. This is the moment you prove you're playing for the shirt. This is the moment you give the energy you rarely give. They're not a team that run the fastest. They ran faster than I've seen them run. They were everything they're not, but it felt like it needed to be Klopp and Liverpool to give them that. So
is that
yes,
not allowed?
Yes.
That
might be. No, I'm not saying it's not allowed. I'm just saying that you brought up demeanour. That's what it looked like to me. It looked to me like he found an out, if you like. He found a way to make everyone on side. Everyone. So for so long in his tenure, the fans have been grumbling about other things. And it's all been about when there's a partial takeover, will he have a job or not? It's not been great in terms of what he can pick upon for motivation. And he found something that was pure from their point of view. Unadulterated. No side issues. This was it. We really need this. We want this. We're giving this to the people.
And they certainly bought into it. Tom, in terms of tactics as well, he was pretty bold, wasn't he?
He was bold, yeah.
Bordering on stupid at times.
He finished with four wingers and two defenders on, did he, I think?
Yeah, Paul Hurst had his formation for extra time as 4-1-4-1. Dallow at right back, Maguire and Fernandez as centre-halves, yeah. Anthony at left back, Christian Eriksen sitting in midfield, and then an attacking five of Diallo, McTominay, Mount, Garnacho and Rashford.
This is the secret.
That's not bad, is
what
it?
Ten Hag needs to do from now on.
Just
know?
Go for it.
Yeah, let them express themselves.
But he did react in different moments in the game. It's not just that extra time, slight madness and cavalier approach.
He did,
and I
think managers have to... reacting in game is not always about kind of tactics and... systems and working out where the opponents are. Sometimes you have to feel the momentum of a match, and I think that's what he felt. You know, he felt we have the crowd here, we have the momentum, Liverpool were there for the taking. You could sense that Liverpool in extra time just didn't have that kind of intensity that they normally have, and that's entirely understandable when you look at their schedule and their squad and their resources at the moment. But I think it was sort of there for the taking, and kind of why not? You know, it's an FA Cup quarter final. I think he probably thought, we can win this game, we've got nothing to lose, you know. And I would like to see a bit more of that from Ten Hag. You know, I'd like to see a little bit more of this, as you say, this kind of, you know, suit wearing coach getting the fans going. I think United for so long have kind of lacked this sense of connection, and you know, it's all very much about, you know, can we play out from the back properly? Yeah, and all that is very important, but actually there is a thing here where you need a coach that you believe in, and you know, you need to have this idea that the players believe in him and that the manager believes in the players, and there isn't, you know, between the fans, the players and the coach for so long, it's been this kind of coldness, you know. And I think we saw, and Alisson's probably right, maybe it was Liverpool, but I also think that this game was United's season, really. I mean, you know, they've got a real outside chance of getting into the conversation with the top four or five, but it's an outside chance. And now they've got a semi-final against Coventry, they've got a great chance of getting to the final. Okay, it might be City, but this was a match that was, you know, if they'd lost it, then there wasn't much left to play for, was there?
Yeah, coming back to that idea that you tapped into, Gregor, in terms of those tactics as well, it's not just at the end. I thought they were brilliant pretty much from the word go, some of the things Alisson talked about there. Getting at Liverpool, pressing quite high up the pitch, being quite brave on the ball.
Yeah, it's like speed, intensity, drive, that, those kind of things. That's what they've lacked a lot of the season. And they were all in evidence in this game. And also, in terms of like the pressing, it's often been like an Achilles heel. He wants the team to press from the front, but then leaves huge gaping holes in midfield. And you know, they don't back it up in the way that other teams who do it successfully do. But in this game, they did. And like I say, it's just... if you look at Old Trafford and all the fans at the game watching this, they saw a team with like... utter total commitment. You could not question their energy levels. You couldn't question any of these things, and that's ultimately that's what they want. That's what when Manchester you look back to Manchester United teams of old and the best teams the Manchester United have. It's always been that kind of slightly wild football as well, like the speed and intensity. That's the thing. That was the thing that really leapt out from this game that we need to see more of as well. Like you. The next question, I'm sure, Tom, is like, what does this do for his job?
And you think, what does this do for his job?
Well, you could, you know, you say, oh, if he wins this and they get in the Champions League, you know, if they win the cup and they get in the Champions League, you think, well, would that save his job? I'm not so sure. I think we'd still need to see more of this.
Yeah,
we need to see more of a stylistic shift, something that you can actually get behind and look to. You know, it doesn't matter if you've got a silver pot at the end of the season. I mean, it'd be great for the fans. It'd be great for the bank balance if they get the Champions League, but they need to see more of this, what they saw on the pitch.
Yeah. Alison, in terms of Liverpool, we're talking a lot about Manchester United, but I want to talk about Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp as well, having asked you about Erik ten Hag. His comments after the game, understandably frustrated, having lost 4-3, having had the lead. Do you think those comments are reflective of that situation you were talking about, where it is Manchester United and he is Mr. Liverpool, he's aware of what huge game this is? Or is it just a case of he kind of has been slightly worried that this kind of a result might have been coming with a very stretched team, played a lot of games, you know, some of those young players, they can't always be brilliant, even though I thought some of them were very good. You know, this wasn't a bad Liverpool performance, was it?
No, it wasn't bad. It just got tired, and therefore you make mistakes when you're tired, basically, is what happened. I think it's a bit of both of those things, Tom. I mean, Arteta's done it. I mean, managers do this. They get annoyed by heated derby fixtures that sort of skew where you should be. So it's sort of like unfair, in inverted commas, that when you're heading towards this farewell tour, you have to meet Manchester United at Old Trafford in the quarterfinal of the FA Cup, because they are going to play differently than they would if they were playing Chelsea or Coventry in the quarterfinal stage. They just are. And as the team that's trying to win something bigger than the team you're facing, they can use that to their advantage. And that, so I think he was dispirited because it's almost like your worst fears of going to Old Trafford as a Liverpool manager came to fruition. Sheer facts and statistics and analysis would show you that Liverpool should have won that. Ahead of the game, they would have thought, we are more than capable of winning this. And the factor you can't factor in is that Man United are going to play the game of their season precisely because it's you. And that I think, accounted for part of his glum and gloomy and annoyed demeanour afterwards. But also, I think you're right. I think he's been juggling his resources. He's been trying to keep a sense of this upbeat momentum, we can do it, making sure he's constantly using the younger players in the right way, not overusing them, but also not making them feel like the minute he's got a few players back, they're peripheral again. He's trying to do that whole, keeping the whole squad not just happy, but integrated and playing as a unit and as a whole. And it didn't quite work. And he will also, I think, have been grumpy because it really was a game in normal time Liverpool should have won. And there was almost, I'm loath to say lazy, I don't mean lazy, but there was a lack of urgency to Liverpool in that second half, because you felt, oh, they've missed that chance. Oh, they screwed up that cross. Another one's going to come in 2 minutes. And they did, but they never quite had that. The urgency you see from Liverpool when they're a goal behind in so many games this season, they suddenly click into another gear. And it's quite scary. They never really looked scary when they were 2-1 up. They looked like they, at some subconscious level, thought they'd done what they needed to do. So I think all of that is something I don't think any manager could have avoided, given their schedule, as Tom points out. But I think it explains, and it makes Klopp's grumpiness understandable.
Yeah, and it's interesting thinking about Klopp and the management of that situation, and you know, the substitutions obviously played a big part in this game. Manchester United, for all we criticise players like Antony, he is still an established first team player who's played a lot of big moments. So coming on and scoring the goal he did does show a little bit of what perhaps Manchester United are expecting of him. Amad Diallo also as well. I'm just going to pat myself on the back, talking to Paul Hurst last week, thinking about this game. I said, why don't you write a piece on Amad Diallo? Whatever happened to him? Paul Hurst wrote a brilliant piece saying that it's not over for him at Manchester United. And so when he came off the bench, I emailed him and said, Amad for the winner? Cue bedlam. Bedlam in the Times office, and much embarrassment for all of my colleagues who had to admit that they hadn't actually read the piece in the first place. But anyway, when it comes to Amad, Alison, I've got a question for you as a qualified referee from Barry, one of our listeners. He says, Tom, please can you identify why players get booked for taking their shirt off? It's not as though he has dropped his shorts or bared his chest. He still had a vest on. 3! It seems it's such an archaic rule when we struggle to get VAR rulings correct.
He's absolutely right. It is archaic. It's based on it being unsportsmanlike, combined with potential time wasting and a chance to rile up supporters. And there was a conversation in FIFA circles about it being inappropriate for certain cultures to see half-naked men.
Mm.
But, yeah, most players now wear vests underneath, and you're going to see semi-nakedness for different reasons when you're watching a football match. So to just penalise the taking off of the shirt in delight, which I think is so commonplace, it cannot now be seen as disrespectful or unsportsmanlike, because it's just a motif we have in sport. It's something you just do because you're joyous and you want to throw it around your head and just be happy. And I think it's really interesting psychologically that even though players know they're going to get booked for it, they still do it. Even if it means they're going to get sent off, they still do it, because it's a gut reaction. It's not a pre-thought through thing. So given that it's not acting as a deterrent being booked, then they should definitely rework what I agree is an archaic rule.
Yeah, that FIFA Rule 3 states that the celebration must not be excessive. Choreographed celebrations are not encouraged and must not be cause excessive time wasting. I mean, they need to get a life, don't they? You ever whip your top off after scoring, Greg?
No.
No?
I don't think, A, there were enough opportunities to do so, and B, I could have planned anything like that either.
That's fair enough. Coming back to Ahmad and also Anthony as well, and Marcus Rashford, that was what I thought was fascinating about this game from a kind of narrative point of view. They kind of followed Ten Hag behind in this kind of slight redemption moment, didn't they, Tom? Which of them impressed you most? Because, of course, Rashford missed a few chances early on, but I also thought he was brilliant in terms of driving the team forward, pressing in a way that perhaps he hasn't throughout the season.
Yeah, and you wonder maybe if those sort of Southgate comments the other day about, you know, his place isn't secure, it's a very competitive spot, whether that's kind of on his mind more than it was before. I thought he played well as well. It kind of reminded me of the Luis Diaz performance the week before against City. You know, he missed a couple of really big chances, but actually you kind of felt he played really well and was very influential in the game. I thought Garnacho was excellent, yeah, as well, you know, of that kind of group. And you look at this little kind of core that United have, and I mean, actually it's not a core, and I think that's kind of the problem. It's a cluster of really good young players, and you kind of feel that this is what we should be thinking about with the United team, you know, with Kobbie Mainoo and Garnacho, Diallo, Anthony, if you want to throw him in there, a couple of others. This is kind of the group that we should be thinking, okay, this is the team that they're building around, but we don't. We're sort of still thinking about this team as a sort of Maguire team and an Eriksen team, and I think that's but we saw in his performance that they've got something, you know. And I agree with, I think, you know, as a for Rashford, I think we need to see more of this in the next few weeks. You know, it's interesting with the England team particularly, and not to stray off into that, but I think he brings something that no one else brings, that England team. And I think if England go into the Euros with him suddenly in form...
What do you think that is?
I think in terms of his directness, his speed in behind, I think England have got a lot of players who like to kind of come deep, Foden, Kane even, Saka likes to kind of come inside. I just think they've got a lot of people who like to sort of drift inside and kind of create, whereas Rashford is that kind of verticality is I think, really valuable for England, but I'm not sure you could pick him at the moment on the basis of his recent form. So if he can kind of deliver some more performances like this, albeit with the chance that he missed, then I think that'd be a huge plus for Southgate.
Kobbie Mainoo as well. He's
that first half.
I love watching him play. The little shuffle. Yeah. Little shuffle run. Like, you know, you see him doing all the things that are really neat and tidy football, and just, you know, simple passes or kind of really good midfield play, but he's really good technically as well, and he can drive forward. I think there's more to come from him as well. That's the impression I was left with from this performance.
And continuing the theme of praising Manchester people connected to Manchester United who haven't got the praise, I want to talk about Bruno Fernandes, because I thought this was the first time when I'd seen a brilliant display and also a proper captain's display that perhaps embodied all those things that you and Gregor have talked about, Alison. Because I was struck a few weeks ago with James Gearbrand on the show talking about him being United's best player. And he never really gets thought of as Manchester United's best player, despite being brilliant, because he gets, you know, criticised for rolling around and always moaning at referees. But this felt like a game where he was the talisman in lots of ways, not just because he finished the game at centre-half as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite cool, really, when you think about it, that he did that. He shouldn't have been on the pitch, though, should he? I mean, it was a strong case for a second yellow card earlier in the match.
But other than that,
yeah, I mean, he's the man you love to hate if you're someone who doesn't like Man United, I suspect, and that's a huge compliment to a player.
I've given you a window there to just kind of be the sophisticated football commentator.
That's a compliment. That is a compliment, because you look at him and he sort of epitomises everything you might not like about the enemy, but it's because he's so good at doing all those itchy and scratchy things. He's always in the referee's face. He's cajoles his player. He never stops talking. He's always talking, and you wonder what he's saying. Sometimes looks like he's berating himself or berating somebody else, or has he got some sort of internal monologue going on? But he epitomises a player full of energy and a desire for things to go his way, and he'll do whatever it takes. So he's incredibly adaptable. So he's capable of delivering an inch-perfect pass. He reads the game really well, but he'll do the dirty things and the annoying things. And as we saw on Sunday, he will shift out of position and play adequately there and not moan about it. So if you were his manager and you owned him, you'd be very happy to have him.
I don't think it's the first time that we've seen that, though. He has kind of taken it upon himself in several games this season when United haven't been at, particularly when they've not been at their best, to kind of try and drag them forward, or, you know,
no,
he's popping up everywhere and playing, you know, diagonal balls and just trying to do something. But he's always combining that with this sort of surly, you know, scowling, like, as you're saying, berating himself, berating his teammates, berating the referee, berating the world, shouting at the sky. Like, if he just lost that bit, I think he'd be one of the most popular players in the Premier League.
Well, yeah, you do wonder how much energy he loses doing that. I mean,
does he need it
to drive himself, yeah, or does it sap him of energy?
Not wrong with a bit of chuntering, especially as on this podcast. Speaking of Bruno Fernandes and talking, he's called on FIFA to scrap the rule that requires referee to book players for removing their shirts. So there you go, Alison, you do agree with them on something. Paul Hurst has written that copy as we record it now. Fernandes jumping to the defence of Amad Diallo, who got that second yellow card. Now, after this thriller, Man United are going to face Coventry. Poor old Coventry fans must have been sat here going, for goodness sake, we thought we had the most dramatic and exciting win of the FA Cup quarterfinals, only to be trumped by Manchester United. But it was an incredible win against Wolves. And as I was discussing with Tony Cascarino yesterday, you know, dramatic, late goals, but they deserved it, didn't they, Gregor? Coventry overall?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that what Coventry have done, and they're one of the best stories in the whole country for about the last 6-7 years, something like that. You know, I think they were in League Two 6 years ago.
Yeah, relegated from League One in the 2016-17 season.
But more recently, you know, there's so much you could talk about with Coventry, about their ownership, and that's finally changed about 18 months ago. One of the most loathed kind of ownerships in the country for a long, long time. But what they've done more recently, after selling their two best players after getting the playoffs last season, getting the playoff final, sold Gyökeres, who's obviously tearing things up now, and Hamer to Sheffield United. And, you know, you think, that's the opportunity gone. Because they were already playing with one of the lower budgets in the division. You shouldn't really have gotten to the playoffs. It was like those two teams, Luton and Coventry, reaching the playoff final last year. Neither of them should have really been there. But, and as I say, that felt like a juncture. They lost their best players. Where do they go now? But they are so smart. Whatever's going on around them, Mark Robbins and Eddie Vivash is assistant, they just get on with it. They've not got the same money as some of the teams with parachute payments. They're brilliant at picking players from other academies who are kind of underappreciated or undervalued.
Ellis Sims being one of them. Because I saw him play for Blackpool on loan as their part of their promotion up from League One. Everton player, of course, 23, pinched him in the summer. Quiet start, but he scored 10 goals since February,
yeah,
though, including a couple of hat-tricks.
Yeah, so him and Haji Wright are the two players that they spent money on, like money that they've never spent before to replace them. And after a little stutter and start, they are coming good now. But you know, Callum O'Hare, who they took from Aston Villa, had some really bad injury troubles, but he's been brilliant. They took Ian Mattson a couple of years ago from Chelsea on loan. Eddie Vivash used to be a Chelsea academy coach, used to take their under-21s. He had great contacts. Casey Palmer, another one. So they do some of the smartest work in the country as coaches, and Mark Robbins just been a brilliant fit for them, despite whatever's going on. And this is just a remarkable story, I think. So, I think they deserved it, and I think they will go into the game against United and think that they have a chance.
Well,
that sounds daft, but the way they set up and the way that they're so well organised, so well coached, I think out of all the teams they could have could have got, I think, the best pleased with Manchester United, partly because of the sort of the Robin story as well.
Absolutely. Alisson, Wolves, a missed opportunity for Gary O'Neill and them looking at this kind of draw, particularly where the ties have panned out, because they scored some beautiful goals as well, actually, I thought as well. Ayet Nouri looks like a great player all of a sudden in recent weeks.
Yeah, no, it was the most curious of the matches over the weekend, because I think everybody would have thought, Wolves class comes good, the game's over. I really don't think at that moment that Wolves relaxed or that O'Neill did something wrong. It's just that sometimes the opposition don't do what you expect them to do, and they at that point they have nothing to lose and they counter. And what I haven't seen much of Coventry, but what I have seen of them is they're very composed on the counter and when they get a chance, which I think is a reflection of their manager, because Mark Robbins, even when it was kind of mad, he still looked really calm and emotionless and like, I'm not doing anything till this is over. It's like
until he then celebrates in front of a ball.
Then he could. At the moment he could, he did. But at that, up until that point, he was incredibly calm. And I don't know. It's really weird. Why shouldn't a team doing really well in the Championship offer a tough test to a team doing reasonably well in the Premier League? I mean, that's what you want from the pyramid, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It shouldn't be like. What I'm trying to say is I don't think we should suddenly start reanalyzing how good we think Gary O'Neill is from this result. I think these things happen, and on the day, Wolves were good and Coventry were just slightly better.
Can I say as well, I think ball boys kind of have it coming. You know, they sort of, there's this idea that they're, you know, very protected species, no one should, but ultimately clubs are kind of like deploying them as these kind of, you know,
agent provocateurs.
Yeah, to do all these things, you know, this sort of dark magic around the edge of the pitch.
You've had a great career, Tom. I always knew you'd bow out in a blaze of glory.
And then, they get shouted at or something, you know, for intervening. And then suddenly it's like, oh, you got your disgusting behaviour, blah, blah, blah. But actually, you know, Wolves and all the other clubs, they're telling them to do these things, you know, to waste time. And so it's the clubs who are telling them to do it that should almost take responsibility, in my opinion. It's no surprise when people get annoyed at ball boys for cheating.
All the hot takes on this podcast. I'm going to let you redeem yourself potentially if in case anyone's offended by your views on ball boys by telling us about some more hot takes. Gerard Piqué, the former Barcelona defender, you interviewed him in the Sunday Times this week, and he talked about how football needs to adapt as a game overall, and he's got some fascinating views on the future of the game, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Gerard Piqué, for people who aren't aware, we kind of retired unexpectedly in the end of 2022, so about a couple of years ago now. And he's always kind of had big business interests going on alongside his career. And I guess the context here is that his latest big venture is this incredibly popular, actually, seven-a-side league in Spain called Kings League, which is being watched by hundreds of thousands of people every week. It's not just some kind of, you know, amateur thing going on in a, you know, pitch in Barcelona. It's being watched worldwide by loads and loads of people. And the whole idea of this thing is that, you know, it's fast, it's fun, it's 20-minute halves. You know, you run for a kickoff, you know, you race to the centre. There's not kind of a kickoff. You know, there's no penalties. It's sort of dribble from the halfway line. It's all the kind of wacky rules that you
don't
can...
Don't they have a rule where, as you approach half-time, some players like leave the pitch or something, and you kind of reduced to like three aside.
They had this like they had like two buckets or something before the match, and you can go and both managers like can pick a card, and the card can be anything basically from take off an opponent for 2 minutes, or we get a penalty, or whatever. You sort of like a trump card, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, some of the wacky rules are kind of. Obviously, very
really
out
wacky.
There. Yeah. I just kind of like.
I'm going to say, right? Mr. Football League sat next to me here with the biggest sceptical look on his face. The bloody game's gone. I can't believe it.
But the general idea is that football needs to be faster, needs to be more flexible. And actually, I guess one of the things is that he's talking about is that sort of technology is kind of being ignored in the kind of traditional side of the game. So he's saying that, you know, he put on a pair of glasses, you know, last week or something, and he was able to watch a basketball game basically from his sofa. He was inside the court, you know, with all the fans sitting, you know, what's it called? Pitch side, you know, and was actually there. And he was saying in 10 years' time or whatever, this is what football's going to be. People don't realise that actually he thinks clubs will be paying fans to go
that
to stadiums.
That line jumped out to me, yeah. That was
paying
that
fans to go to stadiums because people will be able to sit at home and go to the Emirates and not only be there in the stadium, but also say, okay, I want to sit next to Arteta now. I want to sit behind the goal. I want to be on the bench next to Jorginho. You know, you'll be able to just have a complete experience where you can feel everything that you feel by going there, but you don't have to pay a 60 quid to pay on the train and go in the cold. This is his kind of vision for football in the future, right? And it's interesting because, you know, this is one of the greatest defenders, at least, of all time. You know, he played for the kind of most pure Barca team and he doesn't really believe in the kind of attraction of football for the next generation. And it's, I don't really know where I stand on that. I personally, you know, I put it to him, I said, you know, maybe this isn't something we should be encouraging, you know, that kids, you know, he was saying, I watch my kids watch football and they can't concentrate on it for more than 10 minutes. That it's on in the background, but they're on their phones and their laptops. And I can see that, you know, I think that is true. Like a lot of people now don't concentrate and watch football for 90 minutes. And there is probably a thing there, but do we want to encourage that? Do we want to say...
Very Orwellian, isn't it? The idea that you pay the masses, the people who need the money to go to games and cheer.
Yeah, that was stretched
chant.
Too far.
It's a bit like, I don't know. It is. It's very 1984.
Yeah.
But it's always the thing that we come back to around a lot of these conversations, isn't it? About, you know, when we talk about television and you say that part of what makes it great to watch it on television, part of what was great about watching Manchester United was that it was at Old Trafford with 70-odd thousand people there, who made loads of noise and made the drama, and the camera pans to the kid who's in tears at full time, etc., etc. So it's that is the last kind of bastion of hope, isn't it? It's the people going, it's the masses going to the game.
Because they want to.
Because they want to. You know, I went on Saturday.
I don't think that's changing.
But that's what I'm not necessarily sure I agree with PK either, but it's an interesting debate, isn't it? That maybe the kids, if they never experience it, if they never go to a game, you know, Matthew Syed wrote about taking his children to a game and things, and what a lovely experience that is. But if they maybe never experience it, if their experience is watching it while they're on their phone on a big screen, then they can put on some fancy Google glasses and sit there. They're never going to choose to go and be in the, you know, masses of 10,000 euphoric fans at Sinsel Bank like I was on Saturday watching Lincoln win 5-0. Managed to get it in. Get it. But obviously, I'm joking about, you know, the cynical former pro. What did you make of the PK views on the future of the
game? Yeah, I totally understand all the where he's coming from about the way that younger people are consuming football now, but I don't think that you need to. I think he's wide of the mark when he thinks you need to actually change, alter the way that the product is sort of is made, or anything about what's going on inside the stadium. Yeah, I don't think I understand that people are changing the way they consume it, but I don't think you need to. There's nothing wrong with the product.
Because like, he's saying no goals. He's saying why do you? He's saying people go and watch a football match. 90 minutes, they sit there and there's no goals. It's nil-nil. Like, and he's saying the next generation, in inverted commas, they don't understand this. You know, you go to a match and the one thing you want to see, you don't see, and you go home and you spend 200 quid and he's saying no draws. At the end of the match, we pull out some trump cards and see who wins, you know?
Yeah, I think it's madness.
Former defender bristling next to me here. He's absolutely...
I mean, football's in a rude state of health, let's be honest about it. So it's being consumed by more people across the world and, you know, in ever greater numbers than ever before. I agree that the way that it's being consumed is changing, and there are fans, as Tom alluded to there, who will never sit in a stadium and watch it, but they might dream of one day. I don't think that means that you've got to... You know, you'll soon be having to pay people to go and watch the game. I mean, that was madness.
Absolutely fascinating. I'm going to move on before Gregor gets even more disturbed about what we might be doing to the beautiful game. But if you've got views on Gerard Pique and you want to read it, just search Tom's name and Gerard Pique on the interweb and you'll be able to find it. If you've got views or questions, like Barry, want to ask us about Alisson and
I've got a question.
You've got another question?
Yeah, I've got a question, Tom. Did you get that interview with Pique because of the war between Shakira and him, because she did lots of interviews at the same time?
She also did an interview with us on the Times. Yeah, we were thinking, which side are you on?
Are you saying that I'm a pawn in the Shakira PK marriage?
Split, yeah,
or ex marriage? I wasn't aware.
Did not cross your mind.
I will say that they did say before this interview that there could be no Shakira questions.
Maybe that's why he's talking such nonsense about football, to make sure that you're distracted from asking him about his former marriage to the pop
the
star.
The stuff we've seen about being so happy to quit. He's even thought he wanted to quit when he was 30. I thought that was interesting. Like, I knew that existed, but I wasn't sure it would exist, as you say, in someone who's one of the best defenders who ever lived.
And he's claiming that it's widespread. A lot of footballers just see it as a job, and the training's a pain in the arse. And
it's all right, we get it, Gregor. You don't like Gerard Pique. Let it go. Let it go. Let
I admire him for his honesty there.
Let it go and let me do my exit link from the first half of the show, which to come back to. Maybe you want to share your shock that I've only just managed to mention briefly Lincoln's 16 goals in three games. City. Then you can get in touch with me. There we go. tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But stick with us for now, because up next we're talking Fulham, Chelsea and own goals.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Tom Allnut, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. Just when you thought there wasn't anything more revolutionary and shocking that we could talk about in the game of football, Burnley have won a game in the Premier League. Sorry, Burnley fans, that's a bit mean. Well, actually, it's not. Because quite frankly, no one saw this coming. Least of all me, who put loads of Brentford players in his fantasy football team for the weekend. Cheers, guys. Thanks very much. Gregor, Burnley, they've done it. They've given themselves a smidgen of hope.
They have, yeah. Although they briefly threatened to throw it away again.
They did, yes,
as usual. And they needed the opposition to be reduced to 10 men. Regulon, there was a great interview with Regulon with Matt Dixon.
There was, yeah.
In the paper, but it's not been great for him, I don't think.
No, it's a very fascinating career trajectory really that he's had from playing Real Madrid, as he discussed with Matt Dickinson, you know, facing Messi, all the kind of prep he used to do.
I remember a fierce, like, almost fight between Jamie Redknapp and Roy Keane once in the Sky Sports studio about whether he was world class. And Roy Keane was, like, scathing about it. That was Jamie Redknapp trying to argue that Spurs had some good players. Like, it's a bad hill to kind of die on.
He looks good, Reguilón. Like, sometimes, you know. I think he's one of those players that sort of on the surface looks like he's got a lot. You know, he's very up and down. He's quick. He gets to the back post. You sort of think this is kind of modern left back. You know, he's got a good sort of whipped cross, but just doesn't. The actual kind of final product in all ways is kind of disappointing.
And defending, really. That's the biggest.
Well, speaking of his defending, let's quickly get it back to Burnley. Because I did intro on that and now you've started talking about the Brentford left back. So before they throw their phones across the room and email me with complaints, Gregor, Burnley, they were good, weren't they?
So after the red card. They were good. I mean, were they good?
Were they good?
I don't know if they were that good.
They created a lot of chances. They dominated possession.
They often do that, Tom. I watched them at West Ham the other week. And they
took the game to Brentford. I thought Fofana's goal was a lovely goal.
Yeah. Fofana's been a bright spot, absolutely. He's been, although again, he can have some moments where you're tearing your hair out, but he's got something. He can drop deep and turn and run at defenders, and he scored some goals that should have been important goals, but they haven't been in other games. And this one, they were. So, company was punching the air at the end and trying to G up the crowd. They'll think they still have a chance, but they almost found a way to throw away a win again.
But in terms of Company, fascinating that he was talking after the game and in the Times pages this morning about swapping his goalkeeper.
Yeah.
James Trafford, big money signing in the summer, brought in with the view that helping them play out from the back, dropped for Ari Muric, who was the goalkeeper that was part of the promotion campaign. Listening a little bit to Alison Rudd, finally, Vincent listens irregularly to the show.
That's been one of the fans' biggest gripes, actually, They feel, you know, Muric was good for them last season.
Very popular figure as well, isn't he?
And Trafford sort of almost embodied this commitment to buying, you know, kind of like a Chelsea light, where they're buying loads of young kids with no experience, and this is the result. They've got great promise. He will be a very good goalkeeper, but he'd never played higher than League One. He was on loan at Bolton Wanderers last season, so like. And they stuck with him. There was games where he would come out and try and grab a cross and just be bullied, and he stuck with him, and you wonder now whether he stuck with him for too long, like, because you saw his confidence wilt a little bit too. He's good with the ball at his feet, and that was a big part of it. It was almost like the same sort of idea as why David Raya was signed to Arsenal. Muric is not bad with the ball at his feet, but it's not the same. He's not as fluid. It's not like natural. This has been one of the fans' biggest gripes, and he made a couple of big saves in this game, and you know the fact that they won his first game back in, I'm sure he'll be staying there.
Do we think with Kompany and young managers, James Gearbrandt wrote a column quite a while ago talking about young managers and how, depending on the choices you can make in a kind of sliding doors fashion, you can go from being brilliant and top tipped, and when for Kompany faced City in the FA Cup last season, Pep was saying, "Oh, he'll be a future City manager." Do you think there's anything,
it's written in the stars, he said.
Written in the stars, exactly. But do you think there's anything in this idea of, you know, learning this season? Maybe they go back down, stay as manager, come back up again, and then stay up because you're still a young manager. You're still learning. You're learning these things about James Trafford and Muric, learning when to make the mistakes and get things right. In terms of, rather than discard him and then a potentially...
Discard who?
For Kompany.
They won't discard Kompany. Kompany's...
a god.
Kompany's there as long as he wants to be.
You reckon?
Unless something goes really disastrously wrong, and I know this has been a pretty disastrous season, but he absolutely has the credit in the bank with the owners. I think it was starting to fracture a little bit with the fans because he wouldn't really address things honestly in post-match interviews and stuff. He was still saying this is a kind of learning experience, and I think the fans wanted to see a bit more realism. But I think he's there. He's there as long as he wants to be. And yeah, there are merits in what you just outlined there, Tom, but it'll be a big knock for a lot of the young players as well. So it's kind of it's about how you can reset again in the Championship. And yeah, again, when they come back up, is the land going to have changed at all? They're still going to have this commitment to signing a lot of young players, and I'm not sure whether it'll be a different story. The same sort of thing happened to Norwich. The gulf is huge now, and it needs some real investment, and it needs some experience. They had no Premier League experience whatsoever.
Well, maybe they will do next time they come back, because they'll have already had a season of getting pummeled every week. If Brentford were letting me down in the fantasy football stakes, then Tottenham really did screw me over. not least with the fact that I also made the decision to pick Rodrigo Muniz when I played my free hit and then leave him on the bench. It stung. But Tom Allnutt, you were there at Craven Cottage to watch this game. Let's start with Fulham. Rather than do the thing where we talk about Tottenham and go, was this Spursy and, oh, Andrew's, you know, throwing his toys out the pram for the first time, Fulham were excellent.
Yeah, I saw someone on Twitter, someone Fulhamish on Twitter, kind of saying, is it a coincidence that Spurs had their worst game of the season against us here? Brighton did, Forest did. You know, everyone basically claiming that they had their, you know, worst off day of the season away at Fulham, when actually maybe we should give Fulham some credit in these matches. I thought they were brilliant, actually. Right from the off, they just sort of outplayed Spurs. They blew them away. They were much more aggressive, much sharper. They were just killing Tottenham down the flanks. And it made me sort of think this kind of Postecoglou way of playing, where we always kind of hail Spurs for the way their fullbacks bomb on, come inside. But actually, in this game, it felt like, oof, like, why have other teams not done this against Spurs? Because Udogi got absolutely rinsed by Iwobi and Castagna the whole game. And down the left, Robinson was brilliant as well. And they deserved it for them. They could have won by 4 or 5, to be honest. Spurs did have some chances. Son had a good chance in the first half. Late on, Spurs had a couple of good chances. Vernon missed an absolute sitter. Johnson had one as well, and you just thought maybe Spurs had got one, that maybe they might have kind of staged something, but they didn't. It was a really bad day for Spurs. I thought Fulham were really good, and Muniz, blimey, I mean, he's scored what, 7-7
now,
and he's just come out of nowhere. I mean, I wrote a thing after the match about him, because I was looking him up, and he scored 7 goals in 2 years in the Championship for Fulham, one season, Borough, the other season when he was on loan. He's now scored 7 goals in 6 weeks in the Premier League. And, you know, Michael Carrick was kind of talking about him last season and kind of saying, yeah, he's a nice lad, you know, he's training well. You know, all the things you kind of say about a player you don't really believe in, you know. And he played about 50 minutes from January until June. There was talk about cutting his loan short. Just quite clearly a player who wasn't really even doing it in the Championship. And now he can't stop scoring. And I was looking back through his 7 goals. They're all quite similar. Very sort of instinctive, very poacher finishes, very quick at getting ahead of someone. His movement is good.
Yeah, it's not just his goals, is it?
It's not just his goals.
Watch him live. He's a good all-round centre forward.
And
good.
I just think we have seen these kind of flashes in the pan sometimes, you know, players just suddenly just go on a golden streak. But I sort of think he's got something which is quite difficult to prepare for, you know. So, no, I thought Fulham were excellent. And, Muniz, you should have put him in your team.
I should have. Alison, you've been a long advocate for Marco Silva being one of the more underrated managers in the Premier League. This was another masterclass, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's to his credit that Muniz is playing well because he didn't give up on him. I mean, how easy would it be? And he's resisted the pressure, financial pressure, to play Armando from Chelsea. They had a clause that Fulham would have to pay $4 million if they didn't start him a set number of games. And what's happened is him coming in has meant the strikers at Fulham have felt, oh, there's a bit of competition for places here, and it's probably helped spark things up in training and maybe help Muniz just feel like this is my, I've got to show it now if I ever show it at all. And Marco Silva is not the sort of manager. He's very amiable and he gets on very well with the owner, etc., but he will not bow to pressure. He will do what he thinks is best. He's a terribly avuncular manager. So if you're a player that has something and it's not, it does need to be unlocked, he will find a way to do it. So he doesn't give up on play. There are some managers who would just look at the stats that you outlined there, Tom, about Muniz and thought, well, why am I bothering? I'm not going to bother. But he did bother. He did bother and they found a way. And they're a very joyous team. They all buy into it. Training's fun. I've watched training there. Training is fun. And there's a sort of glow about them. And they're sort of trundling along completely under the radar. I think Marco Silva has just created a very good vibe at the training ground. And when, you know, there was a point this season where you thought, well, Fulham are probably going to be the team, win the accolade of losing the most attractively this season. But actually, they're stringing together quite a lot of wins playing attractively. They are lovely to watch. Didn't you find yourself sitting there thinking, wow, that's fun? There wasn't a moment in that game where I wasn't entertained by what they were doing. Mm-hmm. It was fearless. They have pace. They're not stupid in the sense that they go forward all the time. And they've for a long time it was Fulham defected. They know how to defend at Fulham. They've got a really good back four now that understands each other and is solid. And the fullbacks are prepared to go forward in a sort of old-fashioned sort of way. Anthony Robinson is just astonishingly good.
The relationship he has with Willian too, and often Pereira drifts over and they kind of form a little triangle. They've got great sort of, you know, all on the same wavelength. The other thing I wanted to say was, you know, Raul Jimenez was threatened to be a brilliant story as well after, you know, stepping out of the shadow of Mitrovic, hadn't scored a Premier League goal in like well over a year, maybe 18 months. Then he got injured. So he kind of, they've got two strikers there who have taken an opportunity, you know, really grasped it. And, you know, everyone was thinking when Mitrovic left, Fulham going to really struggle for goals. Where are they going to get goals from?
Well,
they need to sign someone in January, but the other two stepped up.
Do you think part of it is looking at the team? They've got Bernd Leno, Arsenal, reject. Timothy Castagne didn't quite work out at Leicester. Tosin Adebayo could have been a bigger player when he was younger.
Still might be,
of course. Alex Iwobi, much derided big transfer to Everton, didn't quite go well. Andreas Pereira didn't make it at Manchester United. Willian mocked slightly in his later stages of his career at other clubs. Do you think that's part of the why they fly under the radar a bit? Because we don't push these players because we're like, well, we're not going to talk about Bernd Leno, are we? Who cares?
Well, yeah, they don't spend big money and they do look like they're an amalgamation of, best you can get for the budget. But this is, again, another good reason to say Marco Silva, wow, what a manager.
They are also 12th. I mean, you know, if they were up in 8th, 7th, pushing for that kind of, you know, we've talked a lot about Wolves and Brighton, for example, you know, who have been kind of in that pushing for that European spots. I guess the thing is that Fulham are about 5 or 6 points short of us saying, wow, what a season. You know, Marco Silva should be in that conversation with the best managers. So there's obviously something not quite there. You know, they, we never really think they're going to get relegated, but equally, you know, they're still in that kind of mid-table bit, aren't they?
Fulham are 12th then. Tottenham, we thought they were charging up the table, Gregor, after that win against Aston Villa. This is a setback, isn't it? And I was interested in what your view was on Ange Postecoglou's slightly spiky reactions after the game to some reporters talking about that battle for the Champions League place. Is this the mask slipping, or is he allowed to be a little bit chirpy and a little bit aggressive?
I think he's always a bit chirpy and aggressive, isn't he?
It just always comes
chirpy's
across.
Chirpy's positive. You mean chippy, don't you?
Chippy, sorry, yeah. Got my chippies and chirpies confused.
Tom's a bit ranting as he's in, you know, in press conferences often.
I know, but you love Ange. I'm just trying
I
to.
Do,
I'm trying,
I do,
you
but
know,
he's always.
I, come on, I've given Alisson a poke about, you know, if the kind of. I'm not going to say.
He had
that,
the thing about plastic fans before the game as well, didn't he, Tom? It was like someone put to him about plastic fans inside the stadium, and he's like. He says things that are unexpected. He sort of leaped to the defence of fans that aren't, you know, your traditional fans. And
he's a contrarian.
He is a little bit.
I think he
is a
little bit.
We love
contrarian. The interviewer. So when the interviewer said, "It's one step forward, one step back,"
yeah,
and he said, "No, it's four steps forward, one step back." If it was what you said, we'd be 18th. Actually, mathematically, no, you'd be mid-table. I mean,
Tom, would you agree? Spiky, chippy, chirper.
Yeah, I mean, I think he likes to kind of he you know, this is where Ange has come from, right? He's sort of anti-establishment, you know. He hasn't come through the routes that all the kind of traditional European coaches have come through. So he sees himself as an outsider, you know, and that is like all over everything he does, you know, in the way he plays the game and the way he answers questions. You know, he sees journalists as asking him questions that come from the mainstream of football, and he's like, I know something you don't, you know. And that's fine. I actually don't find.
So he wasn't spiky.
I don't
in the press
think he was.
After.
He's always spiky, but I don't think he.
What's the spikiest he's been to you personally? Has he ever shot you down?
No, I haven't had it yet, but lots of people have, you know. I don't ever feel he's rude in a sense that sometimes Klopp, for example, can be after matches. You know, he doesn't kind of get a certain personal thing about it. I think he just believes in the way that he sees the game. I actually think, in a way, he has a point with this Champions League thing. You know, we talked about it with Villa like last couple of weeks ago. You know, everyone's obsessed about who's going to finish fourth and fifth, but actually. It doesn't matter that much. You know, I mean, it matters financially. It definitely matters to Villa financially, to be fair. But actually, I can see what he means, where if Spurs just sort of scrape fourth, like they did under Conte, for example, playing OK football, but it's not really going anywhere, then it doesn't mean much, you know. And I think he's basically just trying to get across this idea that actually the more important thing at this point in Tottenham's trajectory under him is that they're playing their way he wants to play, that the style is right, that the players are kind of absorbing the messages, you know. And it all sounds a bit wishy-washy, but I can see it. You know, if Spurs get fourth and go out in the last 16 of the Champions League next year with an extra, you know, 30 million in the bank account, so what, you know?
Gregor, finishing on the fullbacks idea that Tom raised at the start of this segment, the idea of Fulham getting down the flanks, Tony Cascarino picked it out in his column as well today. We talked so much about the Ange way, there's plan A, there's no plan B. Is there a little sense that maybe heading towards the end of this season and into next, that's what he needs to develop, needs to tweak slightly, or needs to be prepared to counter the other managers?
I think it's wishful thinking,
no,
Tom. I think he, look, we all know it's a kind of high wire act, and when it goes wrong, there's a potential for it to go badly wrong, and you know, like Madison tried a little ball kind of around the corner and lose possession, and it can be broke on quite. There's a lot of. I think when Spurs give up chances, they're often quite high quality chances. You know, they're often maybe 3v3 counter attacks, things like that. It's not. That's just the way they play. So they want to outscore you. This is all part of Ange's vision.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we started the show talking about a manager getting a much needed win in the form of Erik ten Hag, and we're going to end with another manager who needed this win, Mauricio Pochettino. 4-2 for his Chelsea side against Leicester. It didn't necessarily look like it was going to be that much of a scoreline for the whole game. But I did think they played pretty well overall, Alison.
Yes, they did, although they have this tendency, Chelsea, and they have done it all through their Pochettino mini era, is that when they ought to consolidate in a game, they become tentative and give the opposition something to sniff at. And that's exactly what they did again. You know, they are the Premier League team playing Leicester, who are probably worrying more about, are they going to get automatic promotion or not? A team that used to be full of stars and is less so now. They should have played that game like they played the last few minutes of that game all the way through. But the minute they get a foothold, Chelsea retreat. I mean, they tactically and emotionally retreat. It is utterly bizarre. And I keep thinking, why do they do this? And it must be their youth and inexperience and lack of, just lack of self-aggrandisement. They just don't have that ego in them yet to feel that they can completely dominate a game. So I think if you're someone who likes watching Chelsea, you're a Chelsea fan, it must be a very frustrating season because they never, ever, and the scoreline sounds emphatic, but actually they were in danger because they invite pressure. They invite it on. It's very, very, very strange that they do that. And also, I think into the mix of that, I think, is the way the crowd react. The subplot, it was a huge subplot, was the interaction of Raheem Sterling on the pitch as a player facing an opposition, as a teammate of his team, his relationship with his manager and the relationship with his fans. It was incredible. It was like watching a soap opera. It was unbelievable.
It was remarkable.
And in the end, you thought, because he saved himself, because at least he tried and he ran around.
And he created
and he did set up a goal.
Yeah.
Set up a goal. But that whole, it was comedy material. He kept finding himself in a reasonable position and ruining it, you know, fluffing it. Bad misses, bad decision making. And then to take the ball off the pen. I mean, there is no, Cole Palmer has taken six and scored six penalties. It's like he's an oasis of calm in this rather strange season that Chelsea are having. Proper class player. And he's, you know, he is therefore the penalty taker. And the only way Raheem Sterling is taking the ball off him, first of all, he's abusing his seniority. He's saying, I'm the older player here, so I'll take it, thank you. Well, is that a good reason to take the ball? He's not taking it because Cole Palmer's missed a few and he thinks, or he's not taking it because he thinks Cole Palmer looks nervous. He never blooming looks nervous, does he? He's the most laid-back player you'll ever see. He's taking it because he wants redemption mid-match. He wants redemption. He's tired of getting booed by his own fans.
That's understandable.
Yes, but unless he scored 100 out of 100 in training all week, why would you do that? And it was an appalling penalty.
It was a really bad penalty. Tom, before you answer that message that just pinged in from Gerard Piqué with another mad idea about football, what do you think about Raheem Sterling? In relation, you were talking about Marcus Rashford at England, of course. Where are we at with Raheem Sterling in England now with where he's at?
He's got no chance getting in England squad, has he? I mean, he hasn't been there for ages, not playing well enough, and there are loads of good players in front of him.
Not even on the experience count?
No, I don't think so. Southgate just doesn't.
He's abusing his experience now, isn't he?
Well, it's also the contrast between him and Cole Palmer. That's the thing. All the things you're talking about, how cool and composed he is and sort of classy and that little, you know, the little game-changing little touches around the penalty box that he it's kind of in quite, I think, in stark contrast to Sterling, which is all kind of frantic. I know that's been, and he's been an outstanding player for England and in club football. But when he's not at it, that kind of is accentuated. He looks like he's, you know, he runs through on goal and he slices it wide. That free kick was like, wow. You know, I think that Palmer is almost sort of, the fans are looking at Cole Palmer and thinking, that's the kind of player we need just now. I think it's almost making Sterling look worse.
But Sterling's always had this, hasn't he? All the way through his career, he seems to be someone who gets a lot of stick from various people, you know? And this, yeah. I don't know what it seems to me that, I mean, footballers have big egos, you know? They all believe in themselves. They all believe that they are as good as they have always thought they are, right? So in this situation, Sterling's image in his head is, everyone's doubting me, everyone's booing me. I know I'm the player that I am. I want to take the ball and prove them wrong. You know, that's consistent with every footballer's personality in the Premier League. You know, and I sort of sympathise in
Absolutely,
a way,
like, yeah.
Because you know he's why
now,
are the
why?
Chelsea?
Why do you sympathise? Because he's taking the ball off someone who has a 100% record.
But why are the Chelsea fans?
It's not there that he doesn't. He's not being paid as a one man show. It's not a circus. He's being paid to be part of a team, and he should want the player who's most likely to score the penalty to take the penalty.
He would have thought that was him.
But there's no evidence that it's him. The evidence is there that it's Cole Palmer.
No logic in football. Who knew?
Why wasn't someone stopping him doing that?
But to be fair, I think that was the thing that leapt out to me the most was Pochettino's sort of nothingness answer to that question. I always support my players' decisions on the pitch. Well, always?
Well, he's got enough problems, Pochettino, hasn't he, without this as well. That was striking, wasn't it? A 4-2 victory into an FA Cup semi-final, and he does end up talking about Raheem Sterling after the game. Just moving on.
As Alison said, it wasn't a 4-2.
No.
I mean, come on, it wasn't.
No, Leicester were very, very good, but I do think Chelsea were the better side overall. I think
it's the same thing about them not... them kind of allowing another team back into it and just never looking secure. You're never confident that Chelsea are going to see out a game, really.
Well, speaking of letting the other team back into the game... De Sassi's own goal, absolutely majestic. So we're going to finish with the chat about own goals and our favourites from down the years. Alison?
The word favourite is wrong for an own goal, isn't it? Because it's schadenfreude.
Most enjoyable?
The most memorable. Memorable, yes, I like memorable.
Most memorable.
Most memorable. And interesting. Because own goals aren't interesting generally, are they? They're mistakes and they're freakish. But the most interesting, with texture... was Peter Enkelman's own goal in the second City derby in 2002, where there was a throw-in, and you can't score from a throw-in, but you can if it touches the goalkeeper's foot and goes in over the line. And then a fan ran onto the pitch and stood in front of him, and he stood stock still. And at the time, everyone's thinking, oh my goodness, you might punch the fan, because the fan flicked his ear. I mean, can you? You've just done something awful. You don't even know. He didn't even know he'd done it. He wasn't sure he'd done it. He was in a bit of state of shock. And then a fan's come on the pitch and flicked your ear. Astonishing. And then it led to all this sort of, well, who knows whether it's an own goal or not? I mean, because he, anyway, I interviewed him. I was amazed he let me interview him about it. And I was sort of, like 1% of me was hoping he wouldn't, because it's a really cruel thing to talk to somebody about. But he went into great, great detail about that day. And he said at the time he was 90% sure he hadn't touched the ball. But he's very honourable, and 10% of him wasn't sure. And so he thinks it might have been an own goal. He just doesn't know.
It was a bobble, wasn't it? It jumped over his foot.
Yeah, but did it touch his foot?
Did it go over his foot or under his foot? I thought he put his foot up to try and control it, and it like scraped his stud.
He barely moved his foot at all. Yeah. That was the point. So he didn't even know if he had touched it, or he didn't know mentally what had happened. So, and he was a hate figure and a joke figure afterwards. And people were laughing at him, because it looked... He looked so robotic and startled by the whole thing. And of course, because it was a heated derby, and I think it was a late kickoff, so there was a lot of sort of moodiness and aggression around the stadium. So it was a very difficult time for him, but he's sort of like, he owned it as a moment in history almost, which was very brave of him. And I don't just like it because he's Finnish, just point that out, because I do have a weakness for... Finland.
Alison Rudd managing to bring some sophistication to a debate about own goals. Tom Allnutt, your favourite, most memorable, most interesting?
I mean, Lee Dixon chipped David Seaman from about the halfway line. I every time I watch it, I'm like, what was he trying to do, and how did he execute it with such accuracy? I mean, presumably he just wanted to play a normal pass back to Seaman, but somehow he lobbed him all the way from the
David
it was
Beckham before
halfway,
David Beckham, yeah. Yeah. These fullbacks, you can never trust them. They don't know what they're doing. Speaking of, Gregor, favourite owner?
Obviously, Chris Brass is the best one ever. But
that name might not be universally famous. So why is that the best one?
Because he kind of kicked the ball onto his own nose, broke his nose, and scored an own goal in the pro.
Thanks. So just for the uninitiated, I thought it was worth
it. Okay, sorry. The one I've chosen though is a Rangers goal, actually.
Who do you support again?
Dunfermline. We'll skip over that. Against Dunfermline in 2003, someone called Paolo Vanoli, who was actually part of Conte's coaching staff afterwards. But it's been described as the most composed own goal ever, because there was Dunfermline hoofed the ball into the box from a free kick, won the flick down, and it fell at Vanoli's feet 8 yards from goal in the middle of the goal. No one really around him. And him and Fernando Rixon do a brief kind of to me to you moment, like these two defenders kind of daintily on their tiptoes, and then he goes to pass it back to the goalkeeper, who's kind of actually coming out, and it rolls like so it trickles into the bottom corner like so slowly, and he's done it all. It's, you know, it would have been a great bit of defending if he just, you know, really coolly laid it back to the goalkeeper. What he didn't see was the goalkeeper's coming out. So that's the one I'm going to write about, and you'll see that on the website.
Sophisticated finish. Yeah, you can read all these guys' suggestions for best own goals. I'm going to finish with an attempt to wind up Alison Rudd even more than I have done already by nominating Jimmy Traore's lovely pirouette back heel for Liverpool against Burnley. That is when I think an own goal can be a favourite, when a defender tries to pull off something, God knows what, and scores a goal that Lionel Messi would be proud of. If you've got any suggestions for your favourite or most interesting or most memorable own goals, get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. That's it for Monday's show. Tom Allnutt, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.